And besides, I thought you liked Wendy. She lives in Houston, Cash says. What about Bonnie, then? Huck can see Cash's neck growing flushed. Bonnie's fine. I went on one date with her. She's nice, but it wasn't a love connection. Tilda means something to me. She let you stay with her for weeks, Irene says. Do you feel like you have to repay the favor? I want to be there for her, Cash says. She can't stay over there alone. He appeals again to Huck. Can we go? We can go, Huck says. First, they stop at St. John Market, which has both registers open and 10 people in each line, including, Huck gathers from eavesdropping, two couples who have only just arrived for a week's vacation at the Westin and who are provisioning with things like Doritos and mango-flavored cruisin' rum. Huck wants to tell these people that their time would be better spent trying to book a flight back to where they came from. For years, there have been false alarms, Cat 1 or 2 hurricanes that fell apart and made landfall as nothing more than 40-mile-per-hour winds and 2 inches of rain. But this storm is picking up power like a snowball rolling down a mountain. This isn't going to be a let's get drunk, play gin rummy, and listen to that Scorpion song on repeat kind of hurricane. Cash buys 2 cases of water, 2 loaves of bread, peanut butter, jelly, crackers, cheese whiz, pickles, a bag of apples, a carton of pineapple juice, and 2 bottles of cruisin' aged rum. He wants beer as well, but Huck steers him toward toilet paper, candles, batteries, bug spray. From their spot way back in line, Huck texts Irene. Fill the gas cans first, then get to the store. This place is packed already. Huck drops Cash off at the Livongo dock. Tilda is waiting at the end in a John Deere Gator. The construction site seems to have been secured, but there's a trailer sitting on concrete blocks, and all Huck can imagine is this bitch Inga picking it up like a toddler with a toy and tossing it into the sea. That's not where you're staying, is it? Huck asks Tilda. No, Tilda says. There's a cottage on the other side. She and Cash load the provisions into the gator. Thank you for bringing him. You two be smart, Huck says. Charge your phones. Do you have a generator? Yes, Tilda says, and plenty of gas. Your place is shuttered? It is, Tilda says. Huck doesn't like leaving Cash all alone on an island. Not one bit. But he realizes he doesn't have any say in the situation, and he needs to get out of there. Be safe, Huck says. Huck is taking his boat to Hurricane Hole, where he will secure it with 3 anchors, strip it of all valuable electronics, then hope for the best. When he pulls into the hole, he sees Captain Stephen and Kelly of the Singing Dog heading out. Where are they going? He wonders. He sees a few boats prepping in the hole, but not nearly as many as he thought he would. He putters over to What a Catch. Where is everyone? He asks Captain Chris. Hurricane Watch just turned a warning, Chris says, and they're advising everyone to pull their boats. This storm is going to be a monster, worse than anything we've seen. Sustained winds of 150 or higher. Huck swears under his breath. The Mississippi can't handle winds like that. Where's the Singing Dog going? They said the boat will be a goner on land or on sea, Chris says. So they're going to try to outrun it. For the love of Pete, Huck says. What are you doing? Staying here or trailering up? I was tempted to chance it here, Chris says. But now I'm having second thoughts. Yes, so is Huck, and the decision needs to be made immediately. He waves to Chris, spins his boat around, and heads back to Cruise Bay. He calls Irene. I need to trailer the boat, he says. Then I have to shutter my house. Or should he shutter first, then deal with the boat? No, he can shutter in the dark if need be. What can I do to help? Irene says. You and Baker are shuttering Hibiscus? Yes, Irene says. I'm making clam chowder, white chicken chili, a Mississippi roast, and your favorite cookies. Ayers is here, and so is Floyd. Phil and Sonny are on their way. Maya is at the school. That's right. Maya begged to be allowed to go to the Gift Hill Gymnasium to assemble and distribute hurricane survival kits, which include gallon jugs of water, flashlights, extra batteries, granola bars, and fudge that some of the mothers made. Because who doesn't need fudge in a hurricane? All of Maya's friends are doing it, she said. Plus, she wants to help.
Can you pick up Maya? Huck asks.
Already planning on it, Irene says. Curfew is at 8. I figure I'll get her around 7:30. Huck breathes out a thank you and marvels at how much better his life is with Irene Steele in it. Huck hitches up his trailer and drives down to Chocolate Hole, where the boat is waiting. Getting the boat onto the trailer by himself isn't something he would do under any but the most dire of circumstances. He should have called Rupert for help, but Rupert is all the way out in Coral Bay, and Huck doesn't have time to waste. He has other friends, but they all have their own boats to worry about. He considers driving back to Fish Bay to enlist Baker's help, but again, there's the issue of time. There isn't a dinghy for Huck to borrow, so he wades into the water up to his chest in order to climb aboard. The air is as hot and heavy as a blanket. The water feels wonderful. The sky glows an ominous green color. It seems to portend danger, destruction. Or maybe that's all in Huck's head. He gets the boat trailered. That ends up being the easy part. The hard part is driving the trailer up Jacob's ladder. He has to take it slowly, begging the chipmunks in his truck engine not to die on him yet. Right before he faces the final hill, the steepest, his neighbor Helen comes out of her house holding a covered plate. Helen was Leanne's best friend, a friend since childhood, though Huck has noticed she's kept her distance since Irene moved in. Chicken, beans, rice, she says. Make sure you eat.
Thank you, Huck says. I will.
But there's no time just then. He gets the boat to the house, unhitches the trailer, secures the boat, and hopes like hell it doesn't go flying and end up through the roof of his house. It's getting dark. He's shuttering the house when his phone rings. Irene.
I ate, he says. Helen fed me.
This is a lie. The plate is on the counter, untouched. But he assumes Irene is calling to check on him.
Huck, she says.
Her voice is an urgent whisper.
What is it?
He cannot go back to Livongo to pick up Cash. Cash is stuck over there, sorry, unless he wants to swim. Irene says something in such a low voice, Huck can't hear it.
I'm sorry, AC, what?
He realizes he sounds a little impatient. It's all fine for her to be making her white chicken chili and Mississippi roast, whatever the hell that is, but Huck has serious tasks to complete, and he's racing against the clock. There's a pause, then a noise, a door closing, and she says,
Ayers is in labor.
Well, she's going to have to wait, he thinks. What kind of labor are we talking about?
Her water broke, Irene says. The contractions are coming every 3 to 4 minutes. It's pretty clear she's not going to make it over to Schneider. We called up to Myra Keating, which is in full-on hurricane mode and has only emergency doctors on staff for the next 24 to 48 hours.
The emergency docs can deliver a baby, Huck says. Go now.
It's almost 7:30 and there's an island-wide curfew that starts at 8.
Wait, where's Maya?
She's still at the school, Irene says. I was about to go pick her up.
I'll get Maya, Huck says.
God damn it, he doesn't have time for this. He still has all the kitchen windows to shutter.
Why don't you take Cash's truck and get Maya, and Baker can take Ayers in his Jeep? Or Phil and Sonny can take her in their Jeep. It's bigger. Are Phil and Sonny there?
Oh, yes, they're here, Irene says. That's the issue. Sonny doesn't think Ayers should go to the health center.
For crying out loud, why not?
I should rephrase that. Ayers claims she's in too much pain to move. And Phil and Sunny have assured her she doesn't have to go anywhere. They're telling her she can just have the baby here in the house.
Is anyone there a doctor? Huck says. If the answer is no, then get that girl to the health center. Have Baker step in if you need to. That baby is his as well.
I've told them all that, Irene says. What if there are complications? But Ayers said she had a checkup at the beginning of the week, and the baby is in place, apparently. Sunny keeps saying that women all across the globe have babies at home, and there's no reason Ayers can't as well. She says it might actually be safer. Huck can't believe this.
I can't believe this, he says.
Apparently it's the low pressure that brings the babies, Irene says. I should go get Maya now. Everyone else is with Ayers. Can you please come home?
And do what? Huck thinks. He's not a doctor, and although he has 60-plus years of wide and varied life experience, he has never delivered a baby. Then he gets an idea.
I'm going to make a call, he says. Long shot, but it's all we've got. You bring Maya home safely, please, and I'll be there as soon as I can.
Huck hangs up and calls Rupert.
This best be an emergency, Rupert says when he answers. Not sure if you heard, but there's a storm coming.
Rupert's lady friend Sadie lives in Coral Bay on Upper Carolina. She's waiting at the bottom of her steep driveway, thank God, wearing blue scrubs and a silk scarf over her hair and holding a small duffel. Sadie is a nurse practitioner up at Myra Keating. Her mother, Blythe, was a midwife, the best in the Virgin Islands. When Huck called and told her about Ayers, she said, If you come get me, I'll help out. I have my bag of tricks right here ready to go. As soon as Sadie climbs in, Huck swings the car around and heads back down the centerline road like a bat out of hell.
It's one thing asking you to deliver a baby at home, and another thing asking you to deliver a baby at home with a Category 5 hurricane on the way.
Low pressure brings the babies, Sadie says. I remember my mama delivering 2 or 3 babies during Maryland in 95.
I'm not sure how I'll ever thank you, Huck says.
I'll tell you how you can thank me, Sadie says. Convince your old friend Rupert to stop seeing Josephine.
Oh boy, Huck thinks.
And Dora.
It's a small island, Rupert, Huck thinks.
He takes the curve above the Reef Bay Trail at breakneck speed. The wind is picking up. Trees aren't swaying. They're bending.
And anyone else he's got on a string, Sadie says.
She slaps Huck's arm. You hear me?
I hear you, Huck says.
Maya.
That was sick,
Maya tells Irene as she climbs into Cash's truck. She puts down the window.
Bye, Shane. Stay safe. Text me.
Buckle up, please, Irene says, and put up your window. It's starting to blow.
We gave out 622 emergency kits, Maya says. Each one with 2 jugs of water, flashlights with batteries, bug spray, energy bars, and matches. The volunteers got to take home the extra fudge.
Maya pulls a piece of fudge wrapped in wax paper out of her pocket.
Do you want some? It's fudge with Oreos.
No, thank you, honey, Irene says. Seatbelt?
It's on, Maya says. Is everyone at the house?
Maya knows this hurricane is going to be very destructive, but she can't help feeling something like excitement anyway. Shane and Bright and Colton and Joni were all at the volunteer effort, and Bright said that every news station in the States is focused on the Virgin Islands. They keep calling it America's paradise. Maya is happy people are paying attention. Normally, the USVI are overlooked because they're a territory and not a proper state.
Cash is on Livongo with Tilda, Irene says.
Ah,
Maya says. She has been waiting for those two to get back together. Maya had caught Cash texting Tilda under the table during Irene's birthday breakfast at Jake's, and when Maya asked if they were starting back up, Cash said,
She's dating someone else.
And when Maya kept staring at him, he said,
It's one text, Maya. Relax.
Your grandfather will hopefully be back by the time we get home, Irene says. And Maya?
Maya has just popped fudge in her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Ayers is in labor.
What does that mean?
She's having the baby.
Tonight?
Tonight, most likely, yes. Or first thing tomorrow. Her water broke. Irene sighs. Her contractions were close when I left the house to get you. And she doesn't want to go to the health center.
Whoop,
Maya says.
Why not?
She thinks that because of the storm, it will be better to have the baby at home.
Like in the olden days, when there were no hospitals?
Maya says.
Yes, Irene says, shaking her head. She hits the gas.
When they get to the Happy Hibiscus, it's chaos. The front door is the only thing left unshuttered for now because people are still going in and out. Phil is on the front lawn on the phone with a doctor friend from Reykjavik who is giving him advice. Sunny is guarding the bedroom where Ayers is. Nobody's allowed in, not even Baker.
Is Huck here? Irene asks.
Not yet, Baker says. Floyd fell asleep, thank God. The dirty cowboy does it every time. Someday I'm going to learn how that book ends. We filled both bathtubs and every pot we could find with water.
He looks at Irene.
You made a lot of food.
We have a lot of mouths to feed, Irene says. How's she doing?
She's working through the contractions on her own for now,
Baker says.
That's what she wants, and who am I to argue?
Huck told me help is on the way, Irene says. Maya hears Ayers groaning in the bedroom.
Sunny says, Make a knot and hang on, Freddy. What should I do?
Maya asks.
There's nothing any of us can do but wait, Irene says.
Phil comes inside as he finishes his call.
Anders says she needs to work with each contraction until it's time to bear down.
That's not helpful,
Ayers shouts.
Does she want some fudge?
Maya says.
No, sweetie, thank you,
Sunny says.
She already lost her dinner. Is that Maya?
Ayers says.
Yes,
Maya and Sunny say.
Send her in,
Ayers says. The room is dark, but there's an outline of light around the bathroom door. Ayers is sitting on the bed crying.
Nut,
she says.
It hurts. They tell you it's going to hurt, but that doesn't prepare you for how white, hot, teeth-crushingly painful it is.
She stands up, paces the room, then sits down again.
Here it comes, Nut. Hold my hand.
Okay, okay. Maya sits next to Ayers on the bed, and Ayers grips Maya's hand so hard that Maya wants to cry out. Ayers is making a wheezing sound that turns to a whimper that turns to rapid breathing. Finally, she relaxes.
Oh, God,
she says. She turns to Maya.
Hi. Hi. Is it over?
For now, Ayers says.
I can't recommend this. Promise me you'll never have children.
Are you sure you don't want to go to the health center?
No, Ayers says. No way. There's a storm coming, Nut.
There is,
Maya says, and they both laugh.
I don't want to be in a hospital filled with strangers when the power goes out. There are going to be emergencies that need to be addressed, and it sits up on that hill. I just don't think it's safe. Plus, I can't ask all of you to come up there with me. I just don't want to go.
But what about the good drugs?
Maya says. Anytime the topic of Ayers' delivery has come up in the past few weeks, all Ayers talked about were the good drugs.
Don't you want the good drugs?
I do, Ayers says. I really do. Here comes another one. Give me your hand.
Reluctantly, Maya surrenders her hand, and Ayers squeezes even harder than before, with nails. And Maya squeals, but Ayers doesn't notice, thank goodness. Maya doesn't want to be asked to leave. She's honored that Ayers wants Maya, and apparently only Maya,
in the room.
You know who I miss right now?
Ayers says.
More than anyone else, do you know who I need here?
Mama? Maya says.
Rosie?
Ayers says, and she starts crying again.
I need Rosie Small right here, right now. You know what she would be doing?
The door to the bedroom swings open, and a West Indian woman in scrubs walks in and says, Rosie Small would be pouring 2 shots of tequila, one for you and one for her. We both know that. The woman puts her hand on Ayers's head. How are we doing, Mama? I'm Sadie. I'm here to deliver your baby. She glances at Maya. You're the spitting image of your mother, sweetheart. If we hit a lull in here, I'm going to tell you some stories about your ancestors. Can you help me with a couple things?
Okay,
Maya says. She will do literally anything to avoid holding Ayers's hand through another contraction. Clean towels, Sadie says. Ice chips. And see if anyone has a Coca-Cola for me. She eases Ayers back onto the bed, spreads her knees, and says, Let me check and see where we're at, doll. Whoa, 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 whoa. We got a baby crowning. Ayers screams through the next contraction. Maya grabs a stack of towels from the bathroom and puts them on the bed. Ice chips, Sadie says. And send the father in here, please. This baby is on its way. When Maya leaves the room, she nearly collides with Phil and Sonny, who are stationed outside the door.
It's time to send the father in, she said.
That would be me, Phil says.
Why Phil and not me? Sonny says. That makes no sense. I think she means the baby's father, Maya says. Baker, bro, it's time.
Baker leaps off the sofa and slides between Phil and Sonny and into the bedroom. Maya fetches a bowl of ice chips and a Coke, but she can't get back into the room because Phil and Sonny are blocking the way. Ayers is screaming. Maya gets tears in her eyes and thinks,
I am never, ever having a baby.
It's incredible that each and every person in this world had a mother who'd endured some version of this. Rosie went through it with Maya. Leanne and Huck were there. Maya hands Sonny the ice chips and the Coke to pass into the room, and then she goes out to the front yard and stands with Huck while he has a cigarette. Maya isn't supposed to hang around Huck while he smokes, but there's a new life entering the world and a hurricane coming, so the usual rules don't apply.
Do you remember when I was born?
Maya asks. Huck exhales, then gives a dry laugh.
Do I remember? Maya Rosalie Small. That was the happiest day of my life.
Ayers screams again. They hear her, even outside.
Must be getting close, Huck says.
Close, but not yet, not yet. When Maya goes back inside, she hears Sadie saying, Push, doll, push for me. And Ayers screaming, I can't. And Sonny yelling out, Push, Freddy, push. Phil gently leads Sonny away from the bedroom door and back to the living room. He says,
I think I'm going to try some of that chili. Do you want some, my love?
Sonny says, How can you think about eating when our grandson is about to arrive?
Or granddaughter, Irene says. And Maya smiles. She knows that Sonny visited a medium on her trip to Croatia, and the medium told Sonny the baby was going to be a boy. Sonny fully believes this, and she has bought 10 outfits for the baby in blue. Ayers screams.
There we go, Sadie says. One more push, doll.
Maya puts her hands over her ears so she doesn't have to listen to Ayers. A second later, Irene jumps off the sofa. Maya drops her hands.
It's a girl, Sadie calls out. A beautiful baby girl.
A split second later, there's a noise unlike anything Maya has ever heard. It's a cry. A baby's first cry. Maya shivers. It's a girl. Her niece. Maya stays up late, because sleeping arrangements in the Hibiscus are a little crazy. Baker, Ayers, and the baby will sleep in one bedroom. Irene will sleep with Floyd. Huck and Maya are taking the sofas, and Phil and Sonny are sleeping in the laundry room on an air mattress. The wind has picked up, but there's no rain yet. The storm is due to make landfall the following day between noon and 2. Once Sadie has finished checking Ayers and the baby, Ayers and Baker haven't given her a name yet because they want to get it just right, and helped Ayers latch the baby onto her breast and taught Ayers and Baker all about newborn care, Huck says that despite the curfew, he's going to run Sadie back to Coral Bay. Maya approaches Sadie as she's scrubbing her hands and her equipment at the kitchen sink.
"We didn't have a lull," Maya says, "so I didn't get to hear the stories about my ancestors. Did you know my ancestors?"
"Well," Sadie says, "my mother, Blythe, was a midwife here on the island, and believe it or not, she delivered your mother."
"She did?"
Maya says. "When I was 14, my mother started bringing me with her to the births," Sadie says. "I'm 50 now. So, 36 years ago, the very first baby I saw being born was your mom."
For a second, Maya is left breathless. Here's someone who wants to talk not about Rosie dying, but about Rosie being born.
"What?"
Maya isn't sure what to ask.
"What do you remember?"
"Your grandmother was the most elegant woman ever to grace this island," Sadie says. "She was a model for a while, you know, in Paris and Milan."
"I know."
"She left all that and came back to St. John to marry Levi Small."
"Did you know my grandfather?"
Maya asks. She checks around the house. Their voices are low, but this topic, Rosie's father, Levi Small, is so forbidden that Maya doesn't want anyone overhearing. It also feels wrong to refer to anyone but Huck as her grandfather.
"Course I did," Sadie says. She dries her hands finger by finger on a paper towel and lowers her voice to a whisper. "He was singing to Leanne the whole time she was in labor, mostly old Motown tunes, My Girl and You Can't Hurry Love. Your grandfather had a magnificent voice."
"He did?"
Maya says. She has never heard anyone say one kind thing about Levi Small.
"He used to sing in the church choir," Sadie says. "He was a soloist. I remember that from when I was younger than you are now."
"Do you know what happened to him?"
Maya asks.
Sadie shrugs. "He left when your mama was little, 2 or 3 years old. Some people say he ran off with another woman. Some say your grandmother kicked him out and told him never to come back. Nobody knows for sure what happened, and nobody knows where he went."
"So he might still be alive?"
Maya says.
"Man I dated before Rupert told me he saw Levi Small playing the piano at a fancy restaurant in Miami, Florida. But don't get your hopes up, honey. The man I dated is very untrustworthy."
Still, it's exciting for Maya to think that she might have one relative on her mother's side left. She imagines being older, in college or in her 20s, walking into a fancy restaurant in Miami, and coming face to face with her grandfather. Sadie bends down and gives Maya a hug goodbye.
"I bet you didn't know your family had so many secrets, did you?"
Huck calls from the living room.
"Sadie, you ready?"
Sadie disappears with a blown kiss and a wave, leaving Maya in the empty kitchen.
Secrets? Maya thinks. My family? Never.
Margaret Quinn. In the 4 years since Margaret Quinn retired as the anchor of the CBS Evening News, she hasn't felt a single pang of regret or experienced one moment of FOMO. She has been quite content to get her news like everyone else, online. Gracing her inbox every morning are the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Skim, the BBC, the Hollywood Reporter, and Refinery 29. She follows New York Magazine and People on Instagram. She still has Time and Vogue delivered to the house. She watches the 6 o'clock news on CBS, but not every night, because she's busy. Her daughter, Ava, and Ava's husband, Potter, and their twins, Maggie and Homer, live in the city, but Ava keeps threatening to move to New Canaan, the lawns, the schools. So Margaret wants to spend as much time as she can with them while they're still just across the park. Margaret and her husband, Dr. Drake Carroll, travel to Boston to see Margaret's son Patrick, his wife Jennifer, and their three teenage boys. And then, often, they take the ferry over to Nantucket to visit Margaret's son Kevin, his wife Isabel, and their children, Genevieve, Kelly, and baby Arnaud. Just this past year, Drake has cut back his surgery schedule at the hospital in anticipation of full-on retirement, so he and Margaret have been able to travel. They took a Viking River cruise down the Rhine and the Rhone. They trekked Milford Sound in New Zealand. It's been a long time since Margaret has been able to travel for pleasure. While she was working, the network sent her places like Kosovo, Tel Aviv, Fallujah, Medellin, Lagos, Haiti, and once, a happy lark, to London to cover William and Kate's wedding. Margaret sits on the boards of three charities, one hospital, one museum, one homeless shelter. She MCs each of these organizations' major benefits. She plays in celebrity softball games. She has been approached by Dancing with the Stars. She said no. And she's been toying with teaching at the Columbia School of Journalism. She's been asked to write her memoirs, but she's nowhere near ready for that. Too much living yet to do. She'd like to write a book describing the magic of being a grandmother, but Leslie Stahl beat her to it. When Margaret's phone rings on the 3rd of September, and she sees it's her former boss, Lee Kramer, head of the studio, she thinks he's calling to make an elaborate excuse for why he and his wife, Ginny, editor-in-chief of Vogue, can't attend the hospital benefit 3 weeks hence. That's fine, Margaret thinks. There are so many worthy causes in this city, and you can't go to everything, though Margaret plans to hit Lee up for $50,000 at least. Don't say no. This isn't the greeting Margaret was expecting. Good morning, Lee. How are you? Please, just hear me out. How are Ginny and the kids? How does Evie like Cornell? I'd like you to come back for one assignment. Thanks for calling, Margaret says. Bye. You don't even know what it is. No, but I know how this works. I say yes to one assignment, then another assignment comes along, then 60 Minutes offers me a 10-segment deal, then you offer me my own half-hour show aimed at baby boomers, and the next thing you know, my grandchildren are seeing me more on TV than they are in person. This is one assignment, and it's your favorite kind of story. Margaret's favorite kind of story is military moms and dads who come back and surprise their children at school. Margaret cries every time. But she knows Lee wouldn't ask her back for that reason. What is it, Lee?
The weather.
Ah, right. Margaret does love a good weather story.
Hurricane Inga, down in the Caribbean, is shaping up to be an event. It's aimed at Antigua and Barbuda right now and will likely hit the Virgin Islands after that. St. Thomas, St. John, Tortola, Virgin Gorda. This is a 100-year storm, Margaret.
Like Katrina?
Like Katrina, yes.
Margaret experiences a surge of excitement so powerful, it's almost sexual. What about Dougie? He already fancies himself the next Jim Cantore, and I don't want to steal his thunder, so to speak. Send Dougie.
Dougie won't go, Lee says. His wife is due to have their first baby tomorrow. So he's going to man the anchor desk on this coverage, and when I asked him who he thought I should send down in his place,
he said me?
He said you.
Even though I retired 4 years ago,
he said you.
Margaret inhales, exhales, looks at herself in the mirror.
They're sending her into a war zone, essentially, so there won't be any hair or makeup, which means the entire country will become acutely aware that Margaret is rapidly closing in on 65. It's flattering. Hell, it's an honor. Not only for Margaret, but for every woman of a certain age, to be chosen to cover this. Just being asked makes Margaret realize she does miss it.
"When do I leave?" she asks.
"When can you be ready?"
Margaret calls Drake at the hospital from her car service to Teterboro. CBS is sparing no expense. She has her driver, Raul, back, and she's flying down on the CBS jet because commercial flights have been canceled. Drake isn't happy.
"I thought this part of our lives was over."
"So did I," Margaret says.
She realizes she sounds giddy.
"Please be safe, Margaret," Drake says. "I need you."
4 hours later, Margaret lands at the Cyril E. King Airport in St. Thomas. The weather is surprisingly clear and sunny, and the island pops with all the bright colors that one expects from the tropics. Emerald green, turquoise, coral, and near blinding white. Margaret didn't tell Lee or Drake this, but she has been to the Virgin Islands before. She and her first husband, Kelly Quinn, came for a week's vacation back when Patrick was 3 years old and Kevin just a baby. They stayed at the Maho Bay campground in a cabin with a canvas roof. Kelly filled a dark rubber bladder with water from the pump and left it in the sun to warm up for a sun shower. It had been rustic, funky, unbearably hot, even more unbearably buggy. Kevin's pale, chubby baby body had been an all-you-can-eat buffet for the mosquitoes. But Margaret had loved every minute of it. Even when they found a scorpion in Kelly's shoe. Even when they got lost on a hike to Ramhead in the scorching heat with Kevin strapped to Margaret's chest. They spent luxurious afternoons lying under a cluster of palm trees on Trunk Bay, where Kelly rented one mask and snorkel, and the two of them took turns marveling at the manta rays and the schools of brilliant fish. When Margaret's marriage to Kelly hit the skids, she'd suggested a getaway to revive the romance. She went so far as to book a week at Keneal Bay, but they never made it. Margaret has always wanted to come back. Now, here she is. The crew from the CBS affiliate picks Margaret up, and although they've reserved her a room at the Ritz-Carlton on St. Thomas, the storm is predicted to be so fierce that the Ritz is no longer deemed safe. Plan B is an emergency shelter in the basement of the CBS studio building. It has cinderblock walls, a buffet catering spread that includes kind bars and packages of ramen noodles. They have a generator. There's a men's room and a ladies' room on the first floor, but no shower. Margaret is shown a cot. She thinks longingly of the Ritz-Carlton. She thinks even more longingly of the king bed in her apartment on the Upper West Side, overlooking Central Park, where the leaves are just hinting at fall.
"We should get our outdoor shots now," the producer, Rhonda, says. "We'll take footage on Sapphire Beach first."
"And then we'll go over to St. John?" Margaret asks.
"Yes, we'll shoot from the dock in Cruise Bay," Rhonda says. "Then we'll come back here and hunker down."
"Good afternoon, Dougie. I'm reporting from the Sapphire Beach Resort in St. Thomas, where, right now, the water looks pretty inviting. However, by this time tomorrow, the scene will be quite different."
"Good evening, Dougie. I'm reporting from Cruise Bay on the island of St. John, where both locals and visitors are preparing for what will very likely be a direct hit from Hurricane Inga."
Rhonda hurries Margaret into the boat. The waves are much choppier on the way back to St. Thomas. The wind has picked up and there's a line of gray clouds on the horizon. Is that the hurricane?
"No, not yet," Rhonda says. "Tomorrow afternoon. If the weather is clement tomorrow morning, they might do one more live report from St. Thomas."
"Let's get you a proper dinner," Rhonda says. "How do you feel about goat?"
Maybe she's kidding. Maybe she's trying to see how tough Margaret is. Well, Margaret drank cow's blood in Nigeria. She ate rattlesnake in China. She's tough. Love it, Margaret says. That night from her cot, Margaret tracks the storm. It's now 215 miles to the east and has sustained winds of 155 knots. This is going to be devastating. Maybe Margaret isn't so tough after all. She's 64 years old and the grandmother of 8. What is she doing here? Has she lost her mind? Both Rhonda and the camera woman, Linda, are sleeping in the studio basement with her. Margaret bids them goodnight, and from her little corner she calls Drake. Then she calls her kids in order of age. Patrick is spending the weekend taking his oldest, Barrett, up to look at Colgate, Hamilton, and Skidmore. He doesn't seem to know there's a hurricane coming, and Margaret decides not to mention where she is. He's bringing Barrett to the city the following weekend to look at NYU and Columbia. Margaret says, "Can't wait to see you," then hangs up, hoping she makes it home in one piece. Hoping she makes it home, period. Kevin is consumed with the closing weekend of Quinn's Surfside Beach Shack. He sounds harried. Arnaud is teething and Genevieve is starting kindergarten. "I can't believe she's going to school already," Kevin says. "It feels like she was just born." Yes, Margaret knows the feeling only too well. Kevin was once that chubby baby who was such a delicacy for the island's mosquitoes. The years, where do they go? Finally, Margaret calls Ava, who says, "I stopped by your apartment today, and Drake told me you're in the Virgin Islands covering that monster hurricane. What were you thinking, Mom?" The next day dawns calm and still. Rhonda makes a big pot of coffee and produces a beautiful tropical fruit platter and a bakery box filled with muffins and bagels. "The cafe down the street saw you on TV last night," Rhonda says, "and insisted on sending these." They head out to do one more live spot for Dougie back in New York. The wind is picking up. The outer wall of the hurricane will be arriving in a matter of hours. "Stay safe," Dougie says. "We'll see you on the other side." Margaret, Rhonda, and Linda go back down to the studio basement. Margaret traces the storm on her laptop. It's coming. She hears the wind screaming like a woman in labor. It must be the situation with Dougie's wife that puts this image in her mind. Then the lights flicker, and the power goes out. The studio's generator comes on, but the lights in the basement are low and there's no longer any air conditioning. Things outside the studio crash, smash, shatter. Margaret can't see what's making the noise because the windows are shuttered. "Dear Lord," she thinks, "please don't let the windows break. Don't let the roof blow off. Don't let the place flood. Please don't let anyone die." But as the minutes pass and then the hours, as the wind gets so loud that Margaret can't hear her own voice praying, as her cell signal cuts out, as she lies on her back unable to even read the book she brought, she marvels at how profound the weather is, how mighty, how inexplicable and unpredictable. Life on these islands is changing right now, right this second, she thinks. Maybe forever. St. John. After Inga left us, as definitively as someone leaving a room and slamming the door behind her, we picked up our heads and looked around. Let's start with Cruz Bay, our downtown. It was ruined. Wharfside Village lost its roof. The beach bar's dance floor was buried under 2-foot drifts of sand. The palm trees along Frank Bay were snapped in half, reminding us of gruesomely broken bones. Someone's boat, Nell, landed upside down on the deck of High Tide, where so many of us had enjoyed rum punches during happy hour. The lumberyard building, home to the Barefoot Cowboy, Driftwood Dave's, the barbershop, and Jake's, looked like the proverbial cake that someone had left out in the rain. The building simply caved in on itself. Homes were violently torn apart, their contents thrown out into the yard, the street. Who could tell what had been a ceiling or a wall or a bathroom door? There was plaster, glass, metal in heaps and piles everywhere. It looked like a bomb had detonated. The damage was atomic, nuclear. Word started rolling in from the North Shore Road, Chocolate Hole, Gift Hill. One family of six survived by hiding in their laundry room. One man crouched behind a table on its side for 3 hours as the sliding glass door across the room bowed in and out as though it were breathing. Multiple witnesses saw telephone poles flying through the air like missiles. Cars were flipped. A couch ended up in the neighbor's front yard. A refrigerator ended up in the bedroom. A hot tub cover was caught in the high branches of a tree. What about beyond the stone gates at Keneal Bay? This was, perhaps, what took us the most by surprise. The genteel, elegant resort had been ravaged. Roofs ripped off, trees uprooted, buildings flooded and filled with sand, the entire place simply annihilated. The centerline road was impassable due to downed trees. The hillside between Maho and Lester Bays looked like a winter landscape. All of the trees were stripped bare, broken, left a burned-looking brown. Eventually, we heard from our friends on the other side of the world in Coral Bay. Shipwreck Landing, one of our favorite places to order coconut shrimp and listen to live music, had been decimated. Concordia, which had such delicious breakfasts, was blown away. Boats were dashed against the rocks, or they capsized and sank. The carnage in Hurricane Hole turned our stomachs. Few of us realized that tornadoes are a common phenomenon when a hurricane hits land. The friction between open ocean and hills can cause spin, especially when the feeder bands roll through. The spot on St. John that saw the most tornado activity was the East End because it has elevation and because it's so exposed. There were 13 tornadoes recorded on the East End alone. Unlike a hurricane, a tornado's path is unpredictable. One villa remains untouched while the villa next door is turned into kindling. The compound belonging to Duncan Huntley was pulverized. When his closest neighbor saw the damage, he said, "It seemed like Inga had a personal vendetta against the place." A cast iron planter that must have weighed 70 pounds had smashed through the roof of Dunk's garage and crushed Dunk's G-Wagon. Every building lost its roof. The 140-inch screen from the home theater ended up in the swimming pool. Nothing was salvageable. The neighbor said that even if Dunk lost his shirt in Vegas, he was still a lucky man. If he'd stayed in the villa, the neighbor said, he'd surely be dead. Imagine our relief when, the morning after the hurricane ended, the singing dog came sailing into the harbor. Captains Stephen and Kelly had successfully outrun the storm. And not only that, they had a working satellite radio that allowed many of us to contact our relatives back in the States to let them know we were still alive. At first, that's all we could claim. We were upright and breathing. The satellite radio also brought news that help was coming. The National Guard and the U.S. Navy were on their way. There was no power, no water. Never mind rebuilding it. Just cleaning it all up would require a Herculean effort. Someone discovered that if you stood on the third floor balcony of the Dolphin Market building downtown, you could get a very weak cell signal. Hey, it was better than nothing. And before we knew it, that balcony was as crowded as the bar at Skinny Legs after the 8 Tough Miles race. A line started to form because someone wisely pointed out that the balcony would hold only so much weight,
and the last thing we wanted was for someone who'd survived the hurricane to plunge to his or her death trying to call Cousin Randy in Baltimore. The balcony and the line to get to the balcony became the place where we connected not only with the outside world, but also with each other. Nestor from Pine Peace Market let everyone know that he would open the store. The owners of the longboard would cook a community dinner, everyone welcome. There would be stir-fry and Chinese noodles over at 420 to Center. Someone declared that what he really wanted was Candy's barbecue, but alas, Candy's didn't survive. Those who had generators and gas offered assistance to those who didn't. Other items we needed included chainsaws, bottled water, shovels, and insect repellent, because the heavy, still hot weather that arrived in Inga's wake brought all the familiar bugs as well as larger, flashier, meaner bugs that looked like they'd escaped from some exotic tropical zoo. Because money had no immediate value, people bartered. Overall, there was a spirit of gratitude and compassion for our fellow islanders, even those we had previously disliked. The hurricane had happened to all of us, West Indian, white, Latinx, Catholic, Episcopalian, Evangelical, Cruz Bay, Coral Bay. Had anyone seen the wild donkeys? Where, oh where, did the donkeys take cover in the storm? No sooner does the storm clear than someone sees Margaret Quinn herself in a pair of hunter rain boots and a bright green anorak broadcasting from the Cruz Bay ferry dock. Margaret Quinn! Candace from the St. John Business Center and several others saw Margaret's broadcast from the night before Inga hit. But the rest of us, of course, were too busy preparing for the storm to casually watch TV. After Margaret Quinn finishes her spiel on the dock, what can she say but that St. John sustained monumental damage that will take a long time to recover from? She insists on walking over to the Dolphin Market building so she can talk to real people. We see her producer and even the camera woman trying to dissuade her, but Margaret Quinn strides ahead. That's why we love her, after all. She's a strong, independent woman who will do what it takes to get to the beating heart of a story. Margaret sees a couple about her age waiting at the end of the line. The woman, nice-looking with a neat chestnut braid, is handing out what appear to be cookies to the people ahead of her in line. "Lemongrass sugar cookies," Margaret overhears her saying, "homemade." This will be her first interview, Margaret decides. A woman who brought homemade cookies to share while she stands in line to maybe get a cell phone signal is someone Margaret would like to meet. "Excuse me," Margaret says, touching the woman's elbow. The couple turn and the woman's eyes widen. "Why?" The man says, "Holy smokes, Margaret Quinn." The woman holds out the platter. "Would you like one? They're lemongrass sugar cookies, homemade." "I'd love one," Margaret says. Their names are Captain Huck Powers and Irene Steele. Margaret had pegged them for a long married couple, but she's apparently mistaken. This must be one of these magic relationships, not unlike Margaret and Drake, where people of a certain age find love later in life. Huck reveals that he's a charter fishing captain who has lived on St. John for over 20 years. His boat is called the Mississippi. Irene is from Iowa City. She moved to the island in February because she needed a life change. Huck wraps his arm around Irene's shoulder and pulls her in close. "She sure changed my life." Who are Huck and Irene waiting to call? Family back in Iowa? "Most of my family is here," Irene says. "My son, Baker, and his girlfriend, Ayers, had a baby last night at home." Margaret thinks she must have misunderstood. "They had a crying baby last night at home?" "They had a baby last night," Irene says. "Ayers gave birth in the bedroom with a nurse practitioner who happens to be a friend of the family. So I have a brand new granddaughter." Margaret can't help herself. "Will she be named Inga?" Oh, Irene says, I hope not.
No, Huck says. They haven't settled on a name yet, but rest assured, it will not be Inga.
Irene says, and that's not all. My other son, Cash. Here, Irene pivots and casts a concerned glance behind them at the water, is over on Lavango Key with his friend Tilda. Her family is building an eco-resort on Lavango, and, if I'm not mistaken, Cash and Tilda are the only two people on the entire island. I'm going to try to call Cash to make sure they made it through okay. This is such a good local story that Margaret feels like she hit the jackpot on the first try. She asks Huck and Irene to repeat all of this, including the shtick about the name Inga, with the cameras rolling. She has Linda get a close-up of the cookies, and then she asks Linda to pan across the water toward Lavango Key. When they finish filming, Irene says, I'm not one to play the name game, but I think you know my cousin. Margaret smiles. She loves this woman, this couple. They're authentic and charming. And even if Margaret has no idea who Irene's cousin is, she might pretend she does.
Who's your cousin?
Mitzi Quinn, Irene says.
Ha, huh,
Margaret thinks.
Ha, ha, ha.
Mitzi? Mitzi is your cousin? Irene nods shyly.
Huck looks lost. Who's Mitzi?
Mitzi was married to my ex-husband for many years, Margaret says. Mitzi's son, Bart, is my children's half-brother. She beams. We're practically related. She pulls out a business card and hands it to Irene. Please, let's keep in touch. If you ever need anything.
Thank you, Irene says.
Margaret tilts her head. Before I move on, I have to ask one more question. How did the two of you meet? Irene and Huck smile at each other, and Margaret can see something pass between them that seems to indicate it's a story too complicated for a soundbite. Of course, Margaret thinks. All the best stories are.
We could tell you, Huck says, but you'd never believe it.
Irene. Cash and Tilda are okay. The cell phone reception when she's talking to Cash goes in and out, but the gist is that they're going to stay on Lavango for a few days to try to clean up before they take the skiff back over to St. John.
It was scary, Cash admits. The cottage shook so bad, we felt like dice in a cup. During the worst of it, I looped my belt through the handle of the front door and pulled, and Tilda sat behind me, bracing me. We knew if we lost the door, the roof would be next.
Irene gets a chill. You should have stayed with us, she almost says. The happy hibiscus didn't sustain any damage because it's made of stone, because it's sheltered from the water, because the yard has only Bismarckia trees, no palms. The wind was loud, the windows rattled. They could hear the branches of the trees coming down, but that was the worst of it. The baby cried a little, which was a sound everyone loved, and Winnie whimpered, which was a sound nobody loved but everyone tolerated. Isn't it lonely being the only two people on that whole island? Irene asks.
Actually, Cash says, it's kind of romantic.
Well, Irene thinks, looks like Tilda is back in the picture. We have a surprise for you when you get home, Irene says.
A what?
Cash says. A surprise, Irene says. There's no answer. A surprise? She turns to Huck. I think I lost him. Suddenly, she hears Cash say,
Thanks, Mom. Hug Winnie for me.
When Huck and Irene leave town, Irene says, Shall we go to your house?
Our house,
he says. He sighs.
Can't put it off forever, I guess.
They've avoided it until now because the most important thing was making sure everyone was safe, including Cash and Tilda. The fate of Huck's house and the boat is secondary. Sort of. If the house is destroyed, where will they live? If the boat is destroyed, how will they live? Slowly, they begin the climb up Jacob's ladder. Irene is surprised when her phone pings with a text. It's from Lydia. "We saw you on Channel 2 with Margaret Quinn," it says. "Congrats on your new granddaughter. Brandon was so happy his cookies made it on TV." There are branches down on the road up to Huck's house that Huck has to clear. One of their neighbors lost his entire roof. It's like someone pried the lid off a jar. Where is it? Somewhere down the hill? The destruction is everywhere and it is epic. There's a truck on its side with the doors ripped off. Entire homes have been reduced to rubble. Insulation and beams and crumbling bricks. The latter looks far, far worse than Fish Bay. When they're still 50 yards away, they can see the Mississippi. Huck exhales. It's a little crooked on the trailer, but otherwise fine. It must have been shielded by the house. Huck jumps out to look at the boat more closely while Irene heads up the front stairs. They still have a roof, and the deck is intact, although the railings are all broken. She has to wait for Huck to retrieve his drill from the truck so he can take the shutter off the front door. Together, they step inside. Something is wrong. The windows in the kitchen have blown out. There's glass everywhere, and the living room looks like it's been ransacked. Lamps have been knocked over, cushions from the sofa are all over the room, everything is wet. There's at least 3 inches of water in the kitchen. The chairs are all smashed. The sugar bowl, the toaster, Irene's food processor are all sitting broken in the shallow pond of their kitchen. There's a palm rat feasting on what looks to be an overturned plate of chicken and rice. Irene gags. Huck comes up behind her. "I'll get him out in a second," he says. "Let's check the rest." Huck and Irene head down the hall to the bedrooms, the bathrooms. They're hot, stuffy, unbearable, but fine. Except, "Uh-oh," Huck says. He emerges from Maya's room with the portrait of Millie. The glass has one long crack down the front.
"I think the actual photograph is okay, though."
Irene takes the frame from him. "Yes, it looks like the picture is okay. What this picture has survived in the past year." "Why, the kitchen," Irene says.
"I didn't shutter the windows," Huck says. "I was about to when you called, and then I got on the phone with Rupert and I had to track down Sadie, and then I thought I'd come back and do it later."
He turns to Irene with tears in his eyes.
"I got so caught up in the baby coming that I completely forgot about those 3 windows. I forgot until just this moment."
"It's nothing we can't clean up," Irene says. The rat has disappeared, though no doubt he's lurking around here somewhere. "I kind of wanted to remodel the kitchen anyway." They remove the shutters from the slider, and Huck checks to make sure the deck boards are secure before they step outside. All the railings are broken. One whole side has disappeared. Irene is sure Huck is craving a cigarette, but he busies himself with stacking the broken pieces of the railing in a pile. The whole thing will have to be torn down and rebuilt. Irene remembers when she used to wake up believing that Russ was still alive. One nightmare in particular returns to her now. Russ staggering down the beach, his shirt soaking wet, his pants ragged. He wanted to tell her something. "The storm is coming. It will be a bad storm, destructive." When Huck turns around, his breathing is shallow. Irene takes his left hand, the one with only half a pinky, and presses it between both of hers.
"Look at this place," he says,
pointing down the hill at the wreckage, which extends all the way to the water.
"St. John is destroyed."
"Damaged," Irene says. "Not destroyed." "Like me," she thinks. This island, and this man have taught Irene some things about resilience, about patience, and most of all, about hope. Bad things can happen, terrible things. You can lose the people you love the most. You can lose homes, cars, antiques, hand-knotted silk rugs that cost five figures. You can discover that the very life you're living is a terrific lie. And despite this, despite all this, the sun will continue to rise. Tomorrow morning, over the bruised and broken body of St. John USVI, the sun will rise again. Irene Steele knows this better than anyone. Epilogue. Millicent Maya Steele. September 6th, 2019. 6 pounds, 14 ounces, 21 inches.
I can't believe you named her after me, Maya says.
We did, Air says. Because you know what, Nut? I want Millie to grow up and be smart and strong and fun. Just like you.
And precocious? Maya says.
Ayers laughs. And precocious. Maya leans over into the bassinet to look more closely at her niece. She's asleep, and her little bow of a mouth is making a sucking motion. Maya reaches out her pinky, and baby Millie's impossibly tiny hand grasps it.
Just watch me, Maya whispers. I'll show you how it's done.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Troubles in Paradise, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Aaron Bennett. Production supervised by Elise Green. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Post-production by Ian Lehman and Jeremy Wesley. Recorded at Literati Audio Studios. Troubles in Paradise is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2020 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.